It was a busy night at Billy Berg's nightclub, especially for a Monday in early December.
The Hollywood Club was packed with movie stars, raconteurs, hipsters, and glitterati, all leaning forward to hear a new kind of jazz called bebop. To set it in context, when America fought a world war on two fronts in Europe and in the Pacific Ocean, there had been another revolution brewing. The pop music of Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman lifted the spirits of a nation at war, but a small group of creative souls declared that music to be boring. So they sped up the tempos, they stirred dissonance into the pot of harmony, and then they created new melodies that had sharp angles in them. They called it bebop or rebop or just simply bop. People out in California had never heard anything like this. So Billy Berg did something special, something slick, when he invited two New York revolutionaries, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, to bring his new music to the club for an extended engagement. They were the bee's knees, the cat's whiskers, the fox's socks, the creme de la creme, which is exactly how the bebop-boppers talked. So here it is, it's opening night in Hollywood. The lights go down, the announcer steps up to the microphone. Dizzy Gillespie counts off the first tune. It's thrilling and it's fast, but where's Charlie Parker? I mean, at great expense, Billy Berg had hired them all to come to California. Dizzy took charge, hired a quintet. There were five musicians now on stage, but Charlie the Bird Parker was not one of them. It seems Dizzy had also hired an additional musician, vibraphonist Milt Jackson, to fill in the band because the Bird had a reputation for not showing up, or at least not showing up yet. As the band performs into the first set, Bird is backstage in the dressing room. He's just finished off a huge meal of Mexican food, the deluxe Comida Conquistador dinner. Tacos, enchiladas, tamales, tostadas, black beans and rice, guacamole, two kinds of salsa. I mean, it's 1945. You can't get that stuff in New York. There are also three empty beer bottles on the counter. Bird wipes his beak, gives a quiet belch or two, and then orders a second deluxe Comida Conquistador dinner. While you're at it, he says, find me a bottle of whiskey. The band will have to keep going on without him because Bird is hungry. Dizzy Gillespie is accustomed to this behavior. That's why he hired a sixth musician for the quintet. When the second set is almost over, Bird pushes back the now empty plates and additional bottles of the second Mexican meal, straps on his saxophone, and wanders back to the back of the club. As the musical set builds to a furious climax, suddenly there's a flurry of saxophone notes. The nightclub air bursts into flame as Charlie Parker hurls his notes into the atmosphere. The tune explodes and concludes. The crowd leaps to its feet in applause. The musicians nod in appreciation, and Dizzy murmurs to Bird, don't ever pull a stunt like that again. He knows full well it could also happen tomorrow. You know, there's a great risk in playing jazz. You set the tempo, you step out on the tightrope. It's not music for those who wish to play it safe. And there's a greater risk of playing jazz in church. It's disruptive. Some onlookers might be drawn like moths to a flame, thinking this is edgy and cool. They never dare come on a regular Sunday, but they'll try out something like this. Meanwhile, the pious and the upright regulars fear that the holy God might snort and blast the whole thing to bits. But for me, the greatest risk of all was playing the music of Charlie Parker in church, because that great musician had a complex and complicated life. Spiritually speaking, he was a mess. He kinds of ways. He was a failure as a grown-up. He was charming, yet manipulative, brilliant, yet caustic. And Byrd ended up blowing up every single relationship in his life, including his friendship with Dizzy Gillespie, which is why the gig in Hollywood got canceled prematurely. And when Dizzy and the others flew back to New York, Byrd never made the flight. He had cashed in the plane ticket to buy some more heroin. Feeding an addiction that had enslaved him since the age of 15 and would last until his death from cirrhosis and alcohol-induced pneumonia at 34. And yet, and I mean and yet, there was no greater saxophonist in the history of American music. None greater. Even John Coltrane thought so. Can you imagine holding together the paradox of such a life? After Dizzy Gillespie quit and couldn't take it anymore, Miles Davis started working with Charlie Parker, and in his memoirs, Miles writes, "I never understood why he did all that destructive stuff he used to do. Byrd knew better. He was an intellectual. He used to read novels, poetry, history, stuff like that. He could hold a conversation with almost anybody on all kinds of things. So the guy wasn't dumb or ignorant or illiterate or anything like that. He was really sensitive. But he had this destructive streak in him," which is quite something for someone like Miles to say. "He was a genius, and most geniuses are greedy." It's an appropriate day to reflect on what it means to be human. To be a genius, but greedy. To be talented, yet needy. To be beautiful, but broken. To be enormously capable and deeply flawed. Some of us might see a reflection of ourselves in that, and I'm here to tell you that's okay. Now, we've heard two scripture texts that kind of held together will explain the human situation. First, Psalm 8, the most affirming words of the Bible. "Who are we, Lord, that you pay us any attention?" And the answer, "You are the children of the Most High, created in the divine image, endowed with holy creativity." As the psalmist sings to heaven about the human family, "You have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands and put all things under their feet." There isn't a more noble description of humanity in the entire Bible. And yet, just inches away from the Psalms is the book of Ecclesiastes. A wise old sage reflects on all he has spent his life scrambling to attain, and he concludes it's like reaching for smoke. The poet says, "I've planted vineyards for myself, cheered my body with wine," yes, read what you will into that, "and created a lot of headaches. I made a lot of money, and it never made me happy. I enjoyed the delights of the flesh, but I never knew love. So I worked harder, surpassed all others, did not deny myself any pleasure. And then I watched as it all turned to sand and slipped through my fingers." Now, a lot of people avoid the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. They say it's a downer. I disagree. It's an honest corrective to self-indulgence. It's a reminder that life is not a banquet of chocolate cake. You've got to eat your broccoli too. Ecclesiastes is a hand raised in objection to the children of God who think they can live without limits, only to find themselves consumed by their consumption. It's a word of wisdom for those tempted toward the foolishness of burning themselves out. It's a well-placed yield sign to to those who think they can speed past all the other warning signs of self-destruction. There's nothing new about this, for the Bible understands who we are. We read the Bible, but it is the Bible that reads us. Earlier in the Jewish Bible, the people conspire to reach heaven by building a big tower. In turn, heaven laughs, the Tower of Babel falls, and the people end up all the more confused. And that's not only in the Bible. There's the old Greek myth of Icarus, who constructs wings of wax to fly into the sky, only to soar too close to the sun where the wax wings melt. Or the more recent question posed by Michael Crichton in his Stories of Jurassic Park. The question goes like this. So you have the technology to clone a Tyrannosaurus Rex, but why would you want to? What are you thinking? So if we hold all this together, we hear the invitation to restraint, to build a more measured view of what it means to be a human being. Yes, we are created a little less than God, empowered, equipped, hovering near the pantheon of angels, but we are still hungry. Hungry for something that a third Mexican meal or some other quick fix will never satisfy. And it's important for us to spend some time working through that hunger and to never allow it to overtake us. For there is a deep pleasure in claiming our dignity, a deep pleasure in reaching high and taking risks and seeking enjoyment in the thick of hard work. In the end, we can conclude with what the wise sage of Ecclesiastes concludes, that life is a gift, not merely an achievement. And we'll endure it only by the grace and mercy of God, who is greater and kinder than ourselves. So let's chew on this today. As the bread is broken, the wine is poured, and the band breaks into the blues. All of us have some hungry place in our souls, and we attempt to fill it 100 different ways, and none of them ever quite work. So maybe today, it's enough to simply lean back and be carried, to remember again that we are loved, to welcome help from a really good friend, and to give something extravagant to the people around us.